My talk is about, well, it has this wide and pretentious title, but it's about various issues that I think are important nowadays. And it was partly inspired, of course, it reflects my own opinions mainly, but it's partly inspired by some ideas that emerged that were deemed important or discussed about during the granular physics session we had at Institut Henri Poincaré, which has ended recently. It lasted for 3 months. It was organized by Alain Barat, Philippe Claudin, and myself. And we had, well, quite a few, a little bit like here, quite a few invited scientists and participants, and sets of lectures, courses on granular flow, sets of lectures of about 8 to 12 hours each, dense granular flows, geophysical applications, and glassy dynamics, given in part by David Dean, who is here. Some course on geometry, rigidity, theory of rigidity, stability by Robert Connelly, who is a math professor at Cornell. Quasi-static rheology was dealt with by Ferran Rajai, and some results, well, lots of results from soil mechanics were presented, contributed by a professor from Tokyo, Fumio Tatsuoka. Well, we had three meetings, and one was called Liquid-Solid Transition. Another one was devoted to the results, mainly in macroscopic continuum mechanics and also in some experimental work on instabilities, bifurcations leading to localizations, strain localization, shear bands. And we had a specific meeting on discrete numerical simulations. You can find some information on the website. If you don't find information, just complain to the organizers. I was mainly concerned in this granular session by solid-like granular materials, quasi-static deformation and related issues, constitutive laws, and how they can be approached from a micromechanical, microscopic point of view. So I will try today, well, I have a selection of some issues that are currently investigated and debated. Well, my presentation is, it's not, of course, will not settle all those issues and hopefully will lead to discussions. Anyway, my talk is way too long. So I hope I can maybe keep some little bits of it that I can show if needed during a discussion. For example, this afternoon, we have a discussion on jamming?
Tomorrow.
Okay.
It was scheduled for today, but we shifted it because not enough people showed up. So there's also a physics department colloquium today. Nothing this afternoon.
Okay.
So Wednesday is pattern formation 3:30.
Okay.
Friday is jamming 3:30. We cannot do it on Thursday because Campbell's stuff is there, and after that there is some discussion. So on Friday 3:30.
Okay, maybe if it can help, some unused parts of this talk can be postponed or can be presented, can be used as material to fuel discussion on Friday then. So my presentation will rely heavily on computer simulation results, and it will focus on material behavior with the idea that I'm going to be faithful to the traditional approach people have in mechanics of materials, or people also have in statistical mechanics, to just to study homogeneous samples and to understand what their internal state is. and later on, of course, the laws that can be identified, the relationships between different variables, can be applied locally in the general inhomogeneous case. That usually leads to boundary value problem. Here's the outline of my talk. I'm afraid I will have to skip some of the points mentioned here. The three main items I have to recall some basic features of macroscopic granular mechanics, and also have to recall what the ingredients of a macroscopic model should be. Then I have selected a few topics in the field of, you know, this microscopic or grain level approach to overall mechanical properties, which are listed here. Well, I love frictionless systems. Other people love them too. So I prepared something on this issue. I have to control myself. Maybe I will shorten that part. Then on system with friction, I'd like to speak about the internal states and the importance of the assembling procedure, which can lead to quite different microstructures and therefore different mechanical properties. I have a few things to say about elasticity, mainly when does it apply and how one can maybe predict elastic moduli. And I'd like to distinguish two aspects of quasi-static response of granular assemblies, which for lack of imagination perhaps I call type 1 and type 2. Type 1 is when deformation is due to the deformation of the contacts themselves. So we're basically working with a fixed contact network. And the second kind of deformation stems from rearrangements of this network, which basically continuously breaks and repairs. So that entails quite different sensitivity to micromechanical parameters and also somewhat different mechanical properties. So these are the things I would like to recall on the traditional macroscopic approach to granular solid, granular material mechanics. So mechanical properties are measured with this kind of device. There are other devices. This one is perhaps the most widely used one. The aim of that thing is to prepare a sample in which stresses and strains are as homogeneous as possible. So this is the triaxial apparatus. Its aim is to control the vertical stress, and the lateral stress too. And the triaxial compression test consists in starting typically from an isotropic state of stress, increasing the vertical stress at constant lateral stress, for example, sometimes constant average stress, and so to see what happens to the material, to measure strains. This is an axisymmetric configuration only, and the principal directions of stresses and strains are fixed. Typically, it's used with this range of parameter, confining stress between 10 and 10 kilopascal and 1 megapascal, typically. Most widely used systems measure strains in the 10 to the power to the minus 2 range. While it is observed, it is basically a shear test. The sample is sheared, but its volume also changes. So one measures the vertical strain or axial strain, epsilon 1, and one measures the volumetric strain. So here I have plotted very schematic curves for a dense and a loose sample. The dense sample here, if I represent this difference, which is the deviator stress, you know, difference in principle in largest and smallest principle stresses, It usually does like this. In a dense sample, it increases up to some maximum, to some peak, and then decreases to a plateau. The loose sample does like that and reaches the same plateau here. The state of the system is referred to as a critical state. It's, you know, a state in which there is a steady plastic deformation without change in volume. This is the volumetric strain curve. I use the convention that positive strains represent shrinking deformations. So this is dilation, this is contraction. A dense sample will first contract a little bit, then dilate and reach constant density at the critical state, and the loose sample contracts all the time and reaches this, which is not apparent here, the same density. So this is the classical phenomenology of those materials. Those strains vary irreversibly. If I go back, I don't retrace the same curve like this. And those devices have now reached a considerable level of sophistication, and some of them can measure strain increments. That's almost unbelievable, of this order, 10 to the power minus 6.
Is it rate dependent as well, or not?
This is not rate dependent.
It is done slowly.
This is done slowly, like typical rates are like 10 to the minus 5th. Second minus one. But nothing changes if you do it faster or slower. This is no plastic flow of a solid material.
But the peak in this,
yes,
associated characteristic length scale. What is
length scale? What do you say length scale?
Is epsilon.
Epsilon is a strain. Strain. It's a,
yeah.
Okay, epsilon is dimensionless.
Strain. This characteristic value that appears at the peak.
There is, well, it's one characteristic of the material. It's how much you have to deform it to reach the peak strength.
It's always order one.
Yes.
How much is it?
It says up there that it's order 10 to the minus 2.
Oh, yes, or about, yes.
Kind of, but that's the minimum.
It depends on the material, it depends on how it's prepared and...
So I guess the question is, does epsilon peak when you go one particle across for each particle separation? That's the question.
Yeah. What's physical?
I think you reach the critical state.
What is physically the origin, what sets the strain scale? Is very mysterious. That's what's being really investigated.
Okay. What about size effects?
Size effects.
If you measure arthritis, quite big.
Oh, no size effects in principle.
It's not possible.
Yes. It's really supposed to be continuum. The continuum limit usually works. Now, this is a very simplified model, which is a reference. People often refer to this model. You know, instead of this curve, replace it by this shape, so it has no peak. It reaches the maximum value immediately. And of course, this maximum should be understood as a maximum stress ratio. That's how it usually works. It's mainly a stress ratio. If we change epsilon 2, sigma 2, sigma 3, the lateral confining stress, the maximum deviator is basically proportional to that confining stress. So that's analogous to friction. That's called internal friction. In fact, if we interpret this in terms of friction along fictitious planes through the material, this level here is sigma 3, the lateral stress, times 1 plus sine phi divided by 1 minus sine phi. And phi is the angle of internal friction. Just this is the value one would obtain imagining friction and inclined planes, in fact. So this is a caricature that is sometimes used by engineers for lack of better models of better information on the material. And this is a slope here. And this part, this traditionally modeled as an elastic modulus, which is very misleading. People knowing the material are aware of this, but one should not assume the material to be elastic in that range. And here, well, if this is an elastic, linear elastic isotropic material, so this is Young modulus, this slope, and that slope here, I should have written a minus sign here, dilatant volumetric strain versus axial strain, that slope should be 1 minus 2 nu. Nu is the Poisson coefficient. And the last characteristic of this, the last parameter, is psi, which is the dilatancy angle. It tells how the material has to increase in volume when its vertical strain increases in that range. It's usually defined in terms of plane strain, and a simple reasoning I won't do here tells us that this slope is in fact 2 sine psi divided by 1 minus sine psi. So these are the ingredients of this caricature model. Yes?
I just want to understand how this compares to the previous plot. Here you have just strain versus stress, stress versus strain, and there you have.
So this is simplified as that shape, that curve, okay?
Yeah, but right.
And that other curve is simplified like this.
Right, but here you have sigma 1 minus sigma 3, and there you have just sigma.
Oh, this is Q, sigma 1 minus sigma 3.
On the next plot, you have just sigma.
Right, but sigma 3 is constant in that experiment. So.
Well, the question is whether it goes to 0 or to something.
Sigma 3, which goes to 0?
Sigma 1 minus sigma 3.
Ah, yes. Well, maybe it's sigma 3 here. If it's sigma 1 here, okay. This level is sigma 3. Okay. And if it's the difference, then this is 0. Sorry. So, while the ingredients in terms of plasticity models are the plasticity criterion, which is this function of stress, reading like this, and phi is the internal friction angle, the same as that one. And if it's strictly negative, then we're elastic. The material behaves elastically, which is a feature of that model, which is not true, in fact, for real materials. And there is the other ingredient called the flow rule. It tells us how the material has to dilate in order to undergo shear deformation, usually introduced in terms of a plastic potential, which tells us that the direction of plastic deformation or the plastic strain rate is proportional with a positive, non-negative coefficient to the derivative of some other function with respect to sigma, and that other function is like that. It has actually the same shape as that one with the dilatancy angle here. Well, everything happens basically as though they were sliding on planes inside the materials, but with some dilatancy angle. They slide on each other, but they have to expand in the normal direction.
Do you have a geometric
interpretation
of psi?
In terms of what the grains do?
No, I mean, sort of, phi is internal.
Yes.
Is there any simple geometric interpretation of psi also?
Well, yes, it's that. It's inside the material. Everything happens as though there were sliding motions on those inclined planes. With, you know, instead of sliding like this, you have to, if this one is fixed, you have psi here. Well, it doesn't deserve to be exposed in and brightly lit, this, you know.
General,
yes.
You know, the right curve suggests that the material just keeps on dilating.
Oh, that's wrong. That's wrong. But you know, that model is used for small strains. And
so this is still in the regime where the strain is like 10 minus 2, something
yes.
like that.
Yes. Okay. Now let's discuss a little bit. Yeah, well, I'm exhausting my time recalling classical notions, but okay, if no problem. Let's discuss a little bit the characteristics of such a model. It contains basic ingredients, the definition of which is fairly or almost model independent. One is the internal friction angle, which can be associated with a peak strength, the peak of the curve. Maximum deviator stress for one given confining stress, lateral stress. There is the strain level necessary to mobilize internal friction you asked me about. That's one interesting characteristic of the material. Where does it come from? It's the question people are studying. And there's this dilatancy angle, usually. It has to be, in fact, smaller than the friction angle. And one has to predict those quantities. Now, of course, this model has severe insufficiencies. There is no difference between peak and residual strength. Among the drawbacks are those. It does not include the role of initial density. Might apply to one material prepared in a certain state with a certain density, but it does not tell us what happens if that density changes. And the most misleading part in the model is that it describes the pre-peak response of the material as elastic. In fact, it's predominantly not elastic and not reversible. Elastic moduli is a very inappropriate term and misleading term for the slope of the stress-strain curve in the epsilon of order 10 to the minus 2 range.
Sorry, about the experiment, actually. I mean, somehow you assume here that actually what you're doing in your experiment is that the sample remains quite homogeneous.
Yes.
But is that the case? I mean, you have boundaries, you probably have shear bands going through your system. So
oh, shear bands happen later around the peak, in fact. But initially, it's okay. It's quite homogeneous. And, people have devised tricks to get rid of boundary effects and, measuring. It's better to measure strain on the sample itself in the central part. And there are corrections for the lateral membrane and lots of things like that. Okay, yes, well, the people have worried about that, and it's fairly, yes.
I guess I have a question which is almost the clone of the previous one I asked. Why does it happen that when, in the very beginning of the experiment, when I just applied the stress for the first time, I happen to have so the ratio of the two stresses 1? I mean, is it understand?
Oh, well, in fact, such models do not apply to the process of making a sample. Those laws are designed to tell what happens given some state of stress, what happens if I change it gradually. So those models really address changes, increments. You know, one should apply stress increments and ask what are the strain increments. You know, the assembling the sample is a process that's really beyond the scope of such models. It's something different and important. But
so the way how it is sort of formulated is I fix the radial stress. Then I approach the critical stress in z direction, right? Which need not to be equal to radial stress. And then, when the motion starts, I record the dependence of the change of the z stress from its critical level as a function of strain.
Yes, well, you don't know the critical level to at the beginning. You just. It's a very, very slow shear test, if you wish, but you also have. It's stress controlled, so the material can expand.
I understand the formulation. I mean, if you're saying correct, then your debater stress is not really C2 minus C3, it's C2 minus C2 naught, where the motion starts.
Oh no, it's the lateral stress is kept constant. It's actually imposed by a fluid, the pressure of a fluid. The sample is is within a membrane, a very flexible membrane, rubber, and immersed in a fluid, the pressure of which is controlled and fixed, for example.
The motion starts immediately after one of the stresses exceeds the other.
Deformation? Yes.
Yes. Deformation of the solid sample.
Yes.
Starts when it exceeds the other. And that is a proven experimental fact. It's always so. I mean, it's there is never difference in the two stresses. It is in this when the motion starts.
You want the material to be perfectly rigid, or?
No. I'm just surprised. I mean, it's almost given here, but it is a material thing.
It's elastic material. It has to deform.
Yeah.
You have both. You have elastic deformation and you have plastic flow, and both are mixed up from the beginning, in fact. Yes, more or less.
Well,
yes.
What I'm saying is that this is quite a pressurable strength, right? Like 10%, but not really.
10%, it's mostly plastic flow, yes.
Yes, of course. So we're talking about much smaller.
Well, we're talking about both. This can be used for both. Okay. Depends on what you want to study, what you're interested in.
Okay,
no.
Okay.
Now, here are some more observations that are... No, outrageously summarized here, because that kind of study of sands in labs, soil mechanics labs, has reached a great level of sophistication. We had these lectures at Institut Poincaré by Professor Tatsuoka, and you know there's a lot to learn in that field on granular materials. What about the elastic range? In fact, one can measure elastic moduli with such an apparatus, with the stress strain, the slope of the stress strain curve, if the strain interval is very small. Usually, within such a tiny strain interval, one can observe really an elastic response, more or less nearly reversible. And why can one be so sure? One good way to check that is that the values of elastic moduli agree, with missing E here, with the ones one deduces from sound propagation measurements. And this was in fact something that was discovered like maybe 15, 20 years ago. Before, people used to think such materials had what they call static moduli, measured with by static experiment like this one on the one hand, and dynamic moduli measured, deduced from wave propagation velocities on the other hand, that were higher. And well, later people learned how to design devices able to measure such small strains, and they realized that those moduli were the same. And what mattered was not the frequency, static or dynamic, but the amplitude of the perturbation, the stress increment, the stress or strain increment. Now, other results are about anisotropy. All those characteristics, pre-peak strains, peak strength, and strain necessary to mobilize the internal friction, all those depend on the initial anisotropy of the material. Usually, there is a special direction due to gravity. In natural sand, for example, deposited in somewhere in nature, or in sand samples made in the lab by deposition. So there is some anisotropy, and its effects on the material properties are very well known, very well documented at the macroscopic level. The effects of stress history, whether the material has known in the past higher confining pressures than the ones it feels now at the time of the experiment, has effects on its behavior, which are also quite well known. Now, there's shear bending that was mentioned, which happens near the peak or sometimes a little before, and which has been studied by a variety of techniques, like just having materials between glass panels and seeing through. Now, this is known as biaxial compression. One dimension is fixed, and you just can see the shear band forming within the sample. Or people have used X-ray tomography too, and they saw these complex networks of shear bands appearing inside their samples.
The first elasticity, is it only a material property or also a function of compaction?
It's a function of the material in the given state it has.
Okay.
So it depends on how it was made, in its geometry, it depends on its density and its confining stress.
There's both the sound propagation as well as the elasticity.
Mm-hmm.
Both the sound propagation.
Yes. In fact, sound propagation is given by material elasticity, like in an ordinary solid. Well, shear bending entails very peculiar particle size effects. But I won't dwell on this issue in the following, because one conclusion of those experimental studies is that, well, you have these size effects and you do need a very large sample to study shear bending adequately. So in simulations, we don't have large enough samples yet, really, to study, to tackle this issue with some good chances of success. And there is slow dynamics and there are creep phenomena which are remarkable and mysterious. All these things are well characterized, and we had lectures on those, which is interesting. What's nice is that, according to our professor at IHP, Professor Tatsuoka, we had these complicated features of material behavior have some practical consequences, which is very good news for research. Here's one little example. I'm sorry, some things are written in French on the curves. It's not very good quality. It was scanned. Fruage means creep. Deformation, you understand that. Deviator stress. You have this deviator stress versus vertical strain, axial strain curve. And if you stop here at constant stress, you have this creep phenomenon. The material keeps deforming very, very slowly. This lasts for hours or for days. And the global deformation that results is of order, this is percent, of order 10 to the minus 3 here, or less, 10 to minus 4. It is somewhat mysterious, and of course the question, does it stop, when and how, is, I'm afraid, not very well settled. experimentalists are not that patient, so after some days they just stop. It was, in a number of experiments, reported to be logarithmic in time, which is maybe the worst case, you don't know. And after some period of creep, if you resume the slow constant strain rate experiment, the material response is very stiff, as you see here. And that slope is actually an elastic modulus. It can be measured in different ways. A little cycling stress increments can be applied to the material here, and the cycles are nearly flat, which means in stress versus strain representation, which means there is very little irreversibility, very little dissipation. So this is nearly pure elasticity. So this is how one can deduce an elastic modulus. Of course, a more traditional way to do it is just to unload, because the beginning of the unloading curve will be very, very stiff, and its slope will be the elastic modulus too. This confirms to the traditional elastoplastic approach. If you keep deforming the material in that way, you actually impose some plastic flow to occur. And what's complicated with this material is that you have this plastic limit, but the flow moves it with along. You know, the plastic domain boundary moves with the material deformation. This is known as work hardening.
Excuse me, is this dry sand, no fluid effect?
Dry sand, yes.
So what is the microscopic understanding of what happens?
Well, there's basically no microscopic understanding, yes.
Vibrations
going on.
Well, that was one thing I was wondering about. I mean, is this thing done on a completely vibrated insulated table? Are the people walking around in the lab?
Well, that's one possible interpretation, yes, that it's the material which continuously feels sort of random perturbations.
Right.
And this small level of noise, like due, for example, to imperfect temperature control and some parts of the sample dilating a little bit, or can lead to that. I think that's one good, possibly that's the right explanation.
And logarithmic relation is generic for such.
Yes, well, yes, that can be argued. I agree. Yes. So well, that's an interesting, you know.
Might be better to say that it can be more easily derived with fewer obviously arbitrary assumptions than other types of relaxations.
Okay, let's see now what the ingredients of a microscopic model are. We have contact laws, which are very schematically recalled here in the two-dimensional case. Well, I have to maybe to move faster to the following of my talk. No, they involve relative normal and tangential displacement at contacts, a relation which are related to the actual particle displacements and rotations by some linear relations, and this defines a matrix I denote as G, which is the rigidity matrix, important ingredient in modeling, mechanical modeling of granular assemblies, this rigidity matrix. Now there is a trap here, there's a pitfall. These laws are superficially analogous to macroscopic laws. We see, for example, this is the tangent reaction, varies like this with a tangent relative displacement. It reaches the Coulomb criterion here, so after that it's flat. This reminds, of course, it is the same shape as the Moore-Coulomb macroscopic law. But one cannot deduce immediately, naively, that, you know, internal friction is just some kind of average of friction between the grains, and that the slope of the stress-strain curve before the peak is an average of the slopes here, which are due to contact elasticity. Okay, sometimes the contact laws are caricatured with those straight lines like this. Of course, more accurate contact laws like the Hertz law will give you nonlinear contact elasticity. And very complex relations are studied, for example, by Mindlin and Derezievich for the tangential part of the contact law. Now, but we have other things that are important in the way a pack of grains responds to stress increments. Those other things are rearrangements and changes in the geometry. The role of geometry is finally as important or more important than the role of the contact law. This is a simple example with frictionless rigid disks. Only one can move. This, it is labeled one, and it can be in stable equilibrium when it touches 2 and 3, which are fixed, or in that gray configuration, or it can be in that position drawn with dotted lines here in contact with 3 and 4. It depends on the external force with components Fx, you don't see, and Fy, vertical here, you apply on it. And this being a frictionless rigid disk, to find its equilibrium position, one has to minimize the potential energy of the external force, subject to the constraint that it does not interpenetrate the other particles, so that those parts of the plane that are covered by hatched lines here are excluded. So this is the permitted zone. These are the equipotential lines, and which are orthogonal to this F vector, the external force. Depending on its value, it will be here or there in equilibrium. And it has this bistability aspect. It starts its position here versus is plotted versus the ratio of force components. So this is a little bit analogous to the macroscopic material, for which the ratio of stresses matters. Here it's the ratio of forces. First it's in that position, then I increase the x component of the force, pushing the particle towards the right. Then at that point, the equilibrium position jumps to the second possibility there. And if I go back, it jumps back to the A position, but not for the same force. So there's this hysteretic curve here. So this very simple material already displays, some kind of internal friction, if you wish, dissipation. And the only ingredients are geometric. Now, if one wants, in general, to model a granular material from the grain level, one has to introduce quite a few material parameters related to the contact law. And if one does some experiment involving some pressure level P, for example, some strain rate, epsilon dot, this introduces those two variables. And dimensionless combinations can be formed with those parameters, which are the control parameters for that experiment. Various choices are possible. I think one convenient set of such parameters is this one. We can define a stiffness parameter, stiffness number, or reduced stiffness, kappa, which is the stiffness of the normal stiffness of the contacts divided by P if the contacts have linear elasticity in 2D, divided by P times A, which is a particle diameter for linear elastic contact laws in 3D. And this is the appropriate definition for Hertz contacts. Why this power 2/3? It's because I want here the typical normal deflection of the contacts divided by the diameter of the particle to be proportional to 1 over kappa. Now the rigid grain limit, one might wonder whether we are studying in practice a situation which is within the rigid grain limit, is of course kappa tending to infinity. Now we have other ratios related to relative tangential or normal stiffnesses, and their ratio, or this is sometimes expressed by the Poisson coefficient of the grain material. Usually this parameter does not turn out to play an important role in the macroscopic behavior. An important one is the one parameter which tells us whether we're quasi-static or not. And it's a convenient choice, which is now becoming popular in the study of granular flow you had this article, you know, GDR, MIDI, collective article using this parameter, inertia number, inertia parameter, I, which is this in 3D, which tells us whether we're going fast or we're going slowly in deforming the material with respect to the intrinsic inertial time necessary to accelerate grains under the typical force. The quasi-static limit is I tending to zero. Now, in laboratory experiments, such as the ones I've briefly presented on the previous slides, this I is like 10 to the minus ninth. Now, in simulations, we can't go that slowly. So we're doing like I.
What is M here?
M is the mass of one grain. In simulations, when we're careful, we can reach I of order 10 to the minus fifth, something like that. Which means that effectively in simulation, instead of compressing, imposing epsilon equal to one in one day, like in the lab, of course they don't go up to one, we are using like 1 second minus one as a strain rate, effectively. So, of course, we have to wonder whether we're really in the quasi-static limit.
Minus five is still worse.
Yes, but this means that I agree with that. In the lab, you could do this with your sample and you would still observe quasi-static behavior. Yes, so this idea is not obvious to everybody, maybe.
I mean, it's a little tricky. I mean, you know, this is a discussion that we had last summer about the it's actually not clear that the kinds of strain rates that one achieves in experiment in numerical work, which are maybe in the 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 3 range, are sufficiently small really to see the asymptotic regime. And when you get down to the contact scale, there are a lot of subtle effects going on, and there are crossovers that occur at remarkably large or small values of these numbers.
But what will give you, what kind of effect will give you five orders of magnitude? I mean, if this parameter is in 10 minus 5.
Well, I mean, the specific example we were looking at last summer was an elastic collapse. I mean, it's a question about whether or not the duration of an elastic collapse event in a collision then involves a time scale that for the duration of a contact versus a time scale for ballistic motion between contacts. And both of those time scales go to zero as power laws, so you can have crossovers between them that are very far out on these kinds of parameters.
That I can believe, but I don't see any such mechanism in
dense packings. You, when you do simulations, you see that it's sometimes quite hard to equilibrate. No, you want to reach equilibrium, and you wait. You have to wait and wait and wait. You have very slow collective modes sometimes, or the system gradually builds a contact network supposed to equilibrate forces, and then it collapses in a corner and it jeopardizes the previous construction.
Is
or
a power law distribution?
A power law distribution of
number of rearrangements needed, induced by a single rearrangement.
Number of rearrangements induced?
Yeah,
this.
If something changes, then there is a sort of avalanche going, right? There is a set of rearrangements going on until settled.
Oh, this is a too specific question at this stage, I'm afraid. We have to know what I'll be happy to speak about that, but to know what the rearrangement is and in what circumstances.
If it is power law, then I can believe that yes, that might be an issue.
And well, then we usually have, of course, the friction coefficient and some dimensionless number telling us how much viscous damping we have put in the contacts. Viscous damping in calculations is often just a trick without any physical justification, really. Some models exist, like the ones used by Thorsten Pushek. But, in general, people rather use this just as convenient tuning parameter. So we have to worry about its influence. So, and now in that, in the attempt to predict macroscopic behavior from microscopic phenomena, we're all aware of this, we're all familiar with this view. Maybe I shouldn't show it. We have these force chains, we have these heterogeneities, and this tells us that averaging the microscopic level to get macroscopic laws won't be necessarily very easy. And we see that we have this disorder, large and small forces, as usual, represented as line width joining centers of disks in contact here. This is a 2D simulation. And we also have a correlation length larger than the grain size, somewhat larger than the grain size. Now there's an almost an equally famous view. It's this one. Yes?
I just have to make a remark. I can't resist making a remark about that, because
please do.
Whenever we talk about granular solids, we always show a slide like that. And I think that...
Okay, it's over now. No, forget it,
okay.
If you wish.
I mean, we should appreciate that this is not at all unique to granular solids, that it is a very common phenomenon in material science to have a mesoscale that, complicates the modeling of materials, but in no way relates to, the impossibility of such modeling.
Oh, I agree with that.
I didn't think you disagreed.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
That's my knee-jerking in response to that slide.
Okay. Thank you. But I guess now the attention of the granular community is gradually shifting towards this kind of view. We also have remarkable heterogeneities of displacements. This is the field of displacement. Particle displacements between two equilibrium states in a, it's not a triaxial because it's 2D, a biaxial compression like this. Increase the stress a little bit, and the next equilibrium state happens when particles have moved. And here the overall mean field or affine displacements corresponding to macroscopic strain have been subtracted out. And we see these complex vortex patterns, and I'd say it's more worrying than the previous view, because each time people have attempted to measure correlation length out of these fields, they obtained correlations apparently extending up to the sample size. Maybe the samples are too small, but it's less easy to find one to be able to state that there is no correlation at large distance in such pictures.
I'm sorry, could you say something about the microscopic model? Is it just MD with like a string dash plot?
Yes. Okay, frictionless systems. What should I do? What time?
What time is it?
It's 7 o'clock.
Hmm?
I mean, well, my suggestion would be that we take a short break and we continue. If that's fine with everybody. I mean, Jean-Noël is only here for 1 week, so we should realize the value from him. As we say in the business world, probably take 5 minutes.
Okay, well, thank you.
Hi.
after you.
I'm afraid I have to leave your program, so I have a phone call.
No problem. It's too long anyway, so...
You're at the half of your schedule, right?
Oh, no, less than this, because I had many questions. And
so you say that people always see correlations up to the size of the system that they're simulating.
Oh,
so
yes.
You know this work by Antong Yi and Jean-Louis Barat on glasses, not granular.
Yes, I know.
So they say there's some finite, you know, like a size of 30 particles or something like that.
Yes, they did larger calculations on softer systems, uh-huh. too. I think stiffness is an issue.
Hmm. Pleased
to meet you. I should have written to you because I was introduced to you by mail, yeah. by Joe Goddard.
Right, yes. And he emailed me and alerted me to you coming here. So I came along to
well, thank you. Thank
I'm,
you for coming.
I've got to. I only have an hour, so I have to.
Oh yes, yes. Well, it's my fault that the schedule talk is over. But
yeah, maybe we could get together and.
Yes.
You're here for this week. Or
for this week. Yes.
Are you free this afternoon? When are you free?
I have to ask. Maybe I'm free this afternoon. I did not quite understand what happens here. Finally, do we have something this afternoon?
No, not this afternoon.
Okay, so I'm free.
So jamming is on Friday.
Okay.
Afternoon,
yes. Well, I'll be happy to.
So, say 2 o'clock.
Yeah, 2 o'clock.
You have an office in this
oh,
building?
Oh, yes, it's 2327.
2327.
Or is it 2723?
I'll find you.
Okay.
2727 or 2723.
Yes, I think the first possibility is the right one. I bet on this one,
okay.
rather.
It's not a big building.
Okay.
I'll see you.
Okay, thank you for coming.
Negative thing because I don't know the community well enough, so I don't know. It's part of the yellow. So I don't know. So when I send this thing, I know. Okay. I don't know whether it's a friend or foe.
Hello.
Bonjour.
Oh, but je ne sais pas, j'arrive à oublier. Ah, peut-être on a dû se voir, mais j'oublie quelquefois les...
C'est le parking lot model.
Oui, oui, oui. D'accord. Et nous nous sommes vus à Lyon en 1990, quelque chose comme ça.
Est-ce que vous savez, Pascal et moi, nous organisons un workshop à Lyon cet été?
Ah, je ne sais plus. Ah, au SECAM, c'est ça?
Oui.
SECAM. J'avais regardé il y a longtemps, mais j'ai eu peur que il m'a semblé que c'était en même temps qu'une conférence à laquelle je devais aller, mais c'est peut-être pas vrai. Sinon, ben je regarde.
27 juin.
27 juin.
Pour 5 jours. It's the same. It's granular gases, but they're not just granular gases. It's also kind of higher compaction.
I will be in that time, but essentially the last one.
Where are you now?
I'm back in
Cambridge.
India.
Oh, sorry. I'm back in England. Back in India. Okay. Oh, we had also met at Cambridge.
Yes.
When I visited Carlos.
Carlos,
yes.
Hello.
Hey.
I could see you.
I haven't met.
Yeah. I met once in Delhi somewhere.
Yeah, so, the thing that's really killing me at the Canes is the inability to get students. What's your name?
Hi.
You've not been in Paris when I've been the EHP.
Maybe not, or we just... I think I saw you once.
Yeah,
I mostly missed the February part. I was willing to go there, but you know, things were happening that I were calling me back to the lab. But
so in Paris now things are almost over, or they're over.
Oh, Institut Poincaré? Yeah. They are over. They've been over since April 8th. Yes. Okay. For more nearly a month.
Are you summing up all these lectures at the EHP?
Summing up, wow. Well, in principle, the PDF files of the lectures are available, but IHP does not traditionally make them available on the website. So far, some of them are available on Alain Barral's site. Others are in some other place, but we will insist that IHP systematically should put the... we have to write a report, so we will say that. In principle, there are links, and you can find them, in principle, but, you know, it's not as convenient as it should be, probably.
If you, I'm around all week. I don't know if you feel comfortable with the test that Mike Ramage has proposed for you. But do you have any questions?
Yeah, I was going
to. I'd be happy to get to you.
Yeah,
I can give you some of the details.
That's great.
I
have a bunch of questions about
the So frictionless systems are very enjoyable. even though a little academic, maybe. They are studied, I think, because we thought they would be simpler. And mechanical properties are certainly simpler. But unfortunately, or fortunately, if we like complicated problems, statistical properties are more complicated. They've been studied by quite a few groups and authors, including Noam Kazel, Tkachenko. Hey, is Alexei Tkachenko here? Was he here in the corner? No?
Yeah.
Okay. And Robin Ball, who was here too, and me. And they are often attributed exotic properties. Well, it's not easy to make a short summary, a short talk about all those issues related to the behavior of frictionless systems. I guess I took one option here. Is I will recall some basic properties, and I will not dwell on some of the possible consequences. So I made the most frustrating choice for the audience, but this should lead to discussions, hopefully. Well, what can be said also is that frictionless systems are also addressed in different literatures than condensed matter physics. There is a whole mathematics literature and rigidity theory. Traditionally, it's applied to bar frameworks. It's also applied to those systems called tensegrities, which are sort of mixtures of bars or struts resisting compression. Only bars resisting both compression and tension, and cables resisting tension only. So this is what is known as a tensegrity structure. So we had lectures by Robert Connolly at Institut Henri Poincaré on those theories and their results. So and it can be found in the literature in discrete mathematics. What's nice about frictionless systems is that in the rigid limit, kappa, rigidity number tending to infinity, oops, properties reduced to geometry. And many of the discussion of the possible role of the contact law parameters can be bypassed. So my choice today is to state basic properties. I think the first one is the minimization property. Well, an important one, the first one maybe, I don't know why. And it just means that the potential energy of external forces to which one has to add the elastic energy if grains are deformable is minimized in mechanical equilibrium. Nothing really surprising. Of course, this does not happen with friction, as we all know. It also applies to rigid grains, in which case we only have the potential energy of external forces and no elastic energy. And elasticity is replaced by impenetrability constraints. And normal contact forces spontaneously appear in the problem as kind of Lagrange multipliers associated with this minimization problem, corresponding to the impenetrability constraints. I like to quote this example, and I like to ask people whether this equivalence is obvious to them. On the one hand, one can consider local density maxima in configuration space, configurations maximizing density, and has to define what density is according to the boundary conditions we're using. And on the other hand, we can define stable mechanical equilibrium states under isotropic pressures. And both sets of states are the same. So that's application, one consequence of this minimization property. It tells us that there is a quite remarkable connection between geometry and mechanics. And that's why, traditionally, people doing simulations and wanting to prepare a dense sample just set the friction coefficient to zero.
Well, I don't really understand that. I mean, the densest packing, the regular structures, which you don't get in three dimensions.
Excuse me?
You don't normally get regular packings in 3D.
Oh, it's a local maximum, local maximum, not absolute maximum in the configuration space, yes.
So there's a theorem that is proven.
Mm-hmm.
There's some kind of a theorem that says that.
Oh yeah, yes. It's just a simple application of optimization theory, in fact. So that tells us that frictionless systems might be interesting for another reason. If we want to study dense systems and compaction strategies, we might study the frictionless case as the ideal case in which all effects of friction have been suppressed, have been circumvented by some appropriate compaction strategy. So compaction strategies, for example, can try to lubricate the contacts or can vibrate the system because the normal force in average won't vanish in contacts that are constantly destroyed and recreated, but the tangential force can be in average considerably reduced. So that can be one reason to study frictionless systems. An important property, which is very briefly stated here, is that when we study this minimization condition, we can write down the first order condition, that to first order in small displacements, any motion satisfying the impenetrability constraints cannot decrease the potential energy. And if such a motion exists with a first order variation zero, it's easy to show that with spheres which have no cohesion, rigid spheres, frictionless spheres with no cohesion, this is an instability. To second order, this will lead to a decrease in potential energy. This is a specific property of spheres, in fact, that has some consequences. Now, other cases are quite remarkable.
Is that true with ellipsoids?
I think it's not true, but... No, I don't think so. It's...
Well, for one thing, you can take a slightly deformed spheres, right?
Well, if that were true, in fact, with arbitrary ellipsoids, you would have coordination number 12.
Actually, there is a range of coordination numbers.
Without friction, yes.
Without friction.
So
can I fix the coordination number with ellipsoids?
So, in fact, that's why I think that. You know, you can have.
I have to say, I asked the question, and I'm increasingly failing to understand.
Well, okay. The ellipsoids is an interesting.
All right, ellipsoids is there's now there the there seems to be a difference of opinion among people who thought about the matter as to whether this applies to ellipsoids. That's the different answer to my question.
Excuse me. So what is the question?
The question is that a property of spheres? Is exactly this issue? Does it just arise from convexity? Does it apply to spheroids as well, or is it a special property of spheres?
I would tend to answer that it's special to spheres, but I might be wrong. That happens.
Specify what
do
you mean on the instability.
I can understand what you emerge from instability, in which sense is it unstable, there is a possible motion that can strictly decrease the potential energy of external forces
with all this you say emotion which will allow you to decrease the volume of the thing?
Oh, well, the volume corresponds to the potential energy in the case of isotropic pressure, but it can be some other strain
right.
combination. Or
then you basically say that the volume, or let's say the energy, is unbound.
Is it really unbound? It's another point, but it's... Anyway, the system will accelerate. It will be forced to accelerate because.
What I'm saying is that if there is no stable point whatsoever, then you can go indefinitely, right?
Yeah, but there can be other stable points. But the point here.
Stable too. I mean,
zero variation. If you have, it means that, okay, the contact structure regarded as a. Set of articulated bars, if you wish, with spheres, you can do that. If it has one floppy mode.
Okay, so you can constrain all the floppy modes.
Maybe we can postpone this discussion. Yes.
Okay, I have maybe a simpler question. I hope it's a simpler question. I'm moving back to number three.
Number three.
Right.
If I think
physically about the energy of one of these systems, there is an energy that corresponds to work done against external forces, and that obviously applies mm-hmm. to that criterion.
Yes.
There is also an energy associated with the elastic deformations of the spheres.
Okay.
So the content of number three is that in that as you go to the rigid limit, that mm-hmm. energy actually goes to zero in order to maintain constant forces at the contact.
Correct.
Okay.
Let's forget for a while about ellipsoids and
is that true in all dimensions?
I think so, yes. Yeah. Mentioned the interesting case when this minimization problem becomes a convex problem. Not at all the general case. In general, this is not the case with rigid spheres. But this is the case for rigid cables, which is an analogous system, just replace the compression by tension. And it is also the case within the approximation of small displacements, which is the approximation that's often done in mechanics problems, consisting in linearizing distance variations. You know, you have one reference configuration with distances between the sphere centers, and you have small displacements, you regard displacements in fact as infinitesimal quantities, and you develop the variation of the distance between sphere surfaces to first order in those parameters. Or in other words, you keep the normal unit vectors at contact constant. I will quote four properties. There are two properties related to isostaticity. This is the first one. Isostaticity properties are in fact properties of the rigidity matrix G, which relates the displacements and rotations of grains to the relative normal displacements at contacts. Here we don't care about tangential relative displacements because there is no force associated with them for frictionless systems. The transpose of this rigidity matrix G has also an interesting role. It appears in the equilibrium conditions. The equilibrium conditions actually reads transpose of G applied to some vector F is equal to vector external forces. This is a vector containing all contact forces. Its dimension is the number of contacts, and because each contact involves a normal force, bears a normal force, and this is the external load, so this is a vector with as many components as there are degrees of freedom in the system. These are forces and possibly torques applied onto the grains. So isostaticity property are basically properties of this matrix, so it's transpose. And the first one tells us that if we have generic disorder, there is no force indeterminacy, which means the kernel of G is of transpose of G is trivial. Kernel of transpose of G is trivial. You cannot find self-equilibrated contact forces. These definitions ignore conditions on the signs of forces.
A definition of the word generic?
A definition of the word generic. Well, the word generic is admittedly vague in that sentence. And what's worse is that there is a notion of generic isostaticity. We should forget about that notion. It does not apply to, well, it's not the appropriate one in our systems. So generic disorder means that, you know, I'm not looking at a perfect lattice. If I need to assume that particles do not have the same radius, I'd better assume it, and things like that. Well, there is a very familiar example of that property. Just take one chair with 4 feet and place it on a 4 rigid feet and make it stand on the floor. And usually only 3 feet will touch the floor, so the chair is, I don't know the English word for it, bancal. Yes, well, it's not, you know, you feel, have...
I would say more wobble.
Wobble? Okay. And it's just because there is no chance that the feet have exactly the appropriate length so that the four points at the bottom can be in the same plane. In the generic situation, there's a small error somewhere. Or maybe the floor is a little rough, and then... only 3 feet touch the floor. And if we have 4 feet, we have force indeterminacy, because only looking at the vertical motion of the chair, it has one vertical translation and it has rotation about 2 horizontal axes. So 3 conditions and we have 4 reactions under the feet. But if we have only three that touch the floor, we have an isostatic problem. As a static problem means no force indeterminacy. So this sets an upper bound on coordination numbers, which should be 4 for disks in 2D, 6 for general objects in 2D, 6 for spheres, 10 for axisymmetric objects like spheroids in 3D, and 12 in general in 3D. And for spheroids and ellipsoids, see.
I guess I have a comment regarding as well for generic objects. The assumption is that you can determine all the forces without changing the geometry of the network. If you consider a case of infinitesimally deformed sphere, so that it becomes ellipsoid, it doesn't create 12 context at once. What happens is that it accommodates some stress by rotation, and we just don't care about it.
This is an upper bound, you know. It just need not be reached.
It
yes.
Has to be stressed. With the sphere, you definitely know its forces. With generic
you're anticipated on the lower bound that will be presented in the next slide.
I don't understand how a if you infinitesimally distort the sphere.
Yes.
Now how, and it would seem to me, so now you want to accommodate all of the new torques that are being generated to lowest order in the distortion.
You accommodate them by rotating the sphere, but not by creating a new context.
Yes, and my problem is that I suspect that you will create more torques. You only have three Euler angles
for the
sphere.
No, you can prove that there is just as many new degrees of freedom, as many torques to equilibrate. So you don't create new contexts, you just rotate.
Fine, then I don't understand. I mean, maybe this is too technical a discussion, but I have to say I don't understand how the infinitesimal counting can be different from the generic counting.
Well, what I'm saying is that the correct claim is that for spheres, you can prove that that Einsteinic network should have connectivity 6 or 4. Mm-hmm. For generical, asymmetrical object in 3D, you cannot claim that the coordination number will be 12.
That's why it's an
between 6 and 12.
Upper bound.
Well, for spheres, upper bound is
this is the contents of the next slide. what it means is that once we know the contact network, if it can balance the load, the external forces, then those contact forces are uniquely determined. If, in addition, the uniqueness property holds, as is the case for cables, or as is the case for spheres too, provided we treat the displacements to first order about one reference configuration, then the list of force-carrying contacts will be also determined, because it's unique. Unique solution for forces. That's not true in general. Now, we had this. I already showed you that. Now, if I doing the approximation, I'm dealing with the distances as linear function of displacements, so this straightens up the boundary of the forbidden zone in configuration space, and now the curve does not have hysteresis. I have a unique equilibrium state here, whatever Q, whatever the applied force is. I know if it's A or B. And this uniqueness gives me, in a sense, elastic behavior, because if this is regarded as, you know, analogous of strain, analogous of stress, there's a one-to-one relation between stress and strain.
There is no proof that this relation is local. If you don't have a local relationship between strain and stress, even if it's linear, then your consistency equation doesn't make much sense.
If you do simulations, if you find that this stress-strain relation is sample size independent and bound independent of the specific boundary conditions you use, then you have your elastic behavior. I claim yes, but we can have this discussion later if we.
I thought we were supposed to have a discussion here.
There are other topics. I mean, I don't know what I should do, but.
I think it's fair. It's fair to say that most people in this room, myself included, are not scholars of the mechanical properties of frictionless packings.
So should we move to frictional ones?
So when you get into these discussions, very quickly we don't know what you're arguing about. So then it becomes a discussion that only three or four people are benefiting from rather than the whole group. So that requires some kind of guillotine across the discussion at an early stage.
Okay, so let's move.
Okay, in the afternoon, in case you want to discuss further.
Well, I'm supposed to. I have one. Okay.
Well, we are going to have these conversations on jamming tomorrow afternoon and Friday afternoon, which will be an opportunity, at least for me, to learn more about the many statements that have been made that based on my naive understanding, seem to be wrong.
So, well, the case of cables is like this. You know, convexity directed in the other direction. So you still have one-to-one relation between this Q ratio of forces and the position, and you still have a unique equilibrium, whatever the applied forces. So, okay, there's no... I think cable networks are elastic. In that sense. But we can discuss about that. Now I'm coming to the second part of the isostaticity property with the lower bound and coordination number. And it's due to the fact that all those, if we have a floppy mode or mechanism in a rigid frictionless sphere packing, then it leads to an instability. So if we have a stable equilibrium, we shouldn't have such mechanisms. And mechanisms are the non-trivial elements, or floppy modes are the non-trivial elements of the kernel of G. So this finally tells us that G should be a square inversible matrix, regular matrix in that case. And that's the definition of what's called an isostatic structure. So the matrix Q, G is square, so there are as many contacts as there are degrees of freedom. And this tells us that we have equality here for spheres only for force-carrying contacts. You can have spheres that do not carry forces, that are just free to move. They're usually referred to as rattlers in sphere packings. So if we exclude rattlers from the count, then the coordination number, that's why there's a star here, Z is the coordination number, Z star is the count that excludes rattlers. It is 6 for spheres and 4 for disks in 2D. And this tells us that, you know, those stable packings of spheres are rigid. So they are isolated points in configuration space. So if we want to change to If there are some strains, some motion, particles have to rearrange and they have to jump to different configurations. They cannot do that continuously only with equilibrium states all along the trajectory. And the last property I wanted to quote, leaving discussion of consequences for other, you know, times, is the usually referred as fragility. Here, these are results of biaxial compression tests, just like the test I have presented before. But we have the lateral pressure, it's in 2D, kept constant, and the vertical stress is gradually increased. And sometimes it destabilizes the network, the packing. It has to rearrange. And then we record the deviator stress interval necessary for the packing to rearrange. And we plot the distribution of such intervals, delta Q, intervals of deviator stress. And it seems that, well, that's a numerical experiment result, simulation result. That distribution seems to be an exponential and seems to scale with the number of particles in the packing, like that. The larger the packing, the smaller the delta Q, with some power, with a funny exponent, that's not one, apparently, slightly larger, decreases like n to the power minus 1.14, 16, 0.11, and something. And this tells us that if I consider larger and larger samples, tinier and tinier stress increments are sufficient to entail rearrangement. So that's why it's called fragile. I think, well, those those basic properties should be taken into account when one tries to deduce some kind of mechanical behavior from either statistically or from the peculiar features of frictionless particle packings. So I'll just say that and move to frictional ones. I think this issue has been, well, lots of people have speculated about that. I think this is still an open question. But I think my opinion is that one should also worry about what happens when there are rearrangements, because basically we always have rearrangements, since a very small stress is sufficient to destabilize existing packings. I think as a statistic can be compatible with elastic behavior, which is the case of cable networks. So if we want to predict, to deduce from isostaticity some exotic properties, these arguments should not apply to cable networks. So this can help, you know, sort the theoretical deductions that can work or that are less likely to work, maybe. But I agree, we should discuss this more in detail. And we should maybe worry about soft grains. Soft grains? Yeah?
Come on. I have a very simple question. In the previous slide, the distribution of the euphoric stress, you have this strange exponent, one dot foot.
Yes. It's just a fit, you know.
So there is no explanation for this.
It's just a fit.
N log n would be 1.14. And log n would be 1.14. And it's from the last search, where the log n comes from.
I was thinking
on, you know, in physical phenomena, you have this. Which could be relevant. That's why I asked it.
That's why log n would
there be is a simple geometric interpretation for that, or you have in mind something?
Well, I guess it's related to the lower the shape of the force distribution for small forces, which are more likely to vanish. You know, what happens is that you change Q and you see you can compute all contact forces because there is a unique solution, and one of them reaches zero, and then you have your instability, and it might be related to how many very small forces are there in a sample of given size, but it might also be related to not only the existing values of the forces but the force increments in response to Q. So it's
not fractal distribution of
I must say I do not know. Well, this probably deserves further investigation. The data apparently exclude one is not no good, you know, with statistical tests.
It was only four words, but you know, what about soft grains? Would you agree that's the case where you both exclude friction and your grains are very hard? Maybe, you know, it's beautifully interesting and all that, but it may be really a singular weird limit, and actually, you know, real materials are both a little bit soft and have some friction, and therefore,
yeah,
you know, a lot of this stuff, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of four-legged chairs in this room.
Well, yeah, there's a carpet.
Four legs of which are firmly on the floor.
Right.
Yeah, the floor is a soft carpet, and that's elasticity.
Well,
yes. Deformability. Yeah.
You know, it still might be a limit that is relevant somehow, but we never really have to use it.
Okay. I have one conjecture about that. No, okay. I can suggest it to you is I would like it to happen this way. I'd like a typical length to exist such that would diverge in the limit of rigid grains. And if my sample is smaller than this, sample size is smaller than this length, what I see is actually the behavior of rigid grains. And if I'm larger, I would.
But I mean, one is more concerned about the influence of friction than of the softness, because friction seems to change the character of the mechanical problem in a very non-continuous fashion.
But for this example of if you vibrated or tapped it, you effectively get rid of friction and you end up in a state as possible.
If you perfectly suppress friction, that's right, but I guess some of it might remain.
It's a good argument that you move toward a friction state where the friction is possible.
Yes, but now if you then, but he's interested now in the solid mechanics of that state, and he's going to deactivate friction the moment he does anything to it.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's turn to frictional systems.
Yeah.
Thank you for the transition. I don't know what I should say and what I should skip, but frictional packing, have much wider variety of microstructures, I think, than frictionless ones. Different solid fractions are possible. I denote it as capital phi. While in fact, I think disordered frictionless packs are really never below the random close packing density. Maybe you don't agree with that. That's the impression I got from simulations.
Sorry, say it again.
If you have frictionless packings, you cannot find stable mechanical equilibrium states below random close packing density.
This is certainly a definition of the phrase RCP density, because I mean you can always make the density higher by
partial crystallization.
So what you're saying is that there's a lowest possible density, which is an extremely